We've done nothing to solve the energy dependency situation. We have been able to accomplish next to nothing to solve the Palestinian crisis. These and the continued stark discrepancy between the haves and the have-nots in the Middle East, fueling a growing anti-Western Arab nationalism, are the deep contours of the Middle East landscape. Unless we roll up our sleeves on these fundamental questions in the region and work with a true international coalition against them, we will have no end to the series of sorry episodes that have weighed us down for more than a decade now. War will not solve the root problems of the Middle East, and we've said that, and we've known it. Only a long-term commitment with resolve and patience and dedication and the will to succeed will we be able to address the complexities of the region. They say sanctions are not working. Well, Mr. President, sanctions are working. Saddam's spare parts cannot be replenished. His equipment that is cannibalized for the purpose of securing spare parts cannot be made whole again. With us, it is different. I've been a strong supporter of the President's decisive actions to respond to the defensive needs of Saudi Arabia and to punish Iraq for its invasion of Kuwait through an economic embargo. These twin goals have been largely successful. Who expected them to work by now? Even the President did not expect them to work so quickly. Saudi Arabia has been safeguarded from Iraqi invasion, and the economic stranglehold being tightened around Iraq's economy has not only denied any economic benefit from the aggression, but has begun to cripple the Iraqi economy. These actions have enjoyed substantial and continued support from the American people and from the Congress, as well as from the international community. So, Mr. President, to those who say sanctions are not working, have we forgotten so soon the celebrations of last year when we so correctly congratulated ourselves on the crumbling of the Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe after more than 40 years? 40 years of patience, willpower, strength, and resolve. We were patient for 40 years. What has happened to that patience? Let us remember the lessons of history. Edward Gibbon spoke of the Battle of Hadrianople. The Roman Empire was divided into the Western Empire and the Eastern Empire. Valens was the emperor of the East. He was the brother of Valentinian, the uncle of Gratian, who was the emperor of the West. The Goths had gathered just a dozen miles from Hadrianople. Gratian was on his way to assist his uncle, the emperor of the East, Valens. But Valens was impetuous. He did not want to wait and share the glory of a victory with Gratian, his nephew. And so he rushed onto the field, and in one afternoon, two-thirds of the Roman army was destroyed. Almost as many Romans killed and captured as died at the Battle of Cannae in 216. in 216 B.C. And so, Mr. President, had Valens exercised patience, that victory might have been won, and the Goths might have been defeated. Patience, Mr. President, a superpower doesn't have to be a patient. Aristotle told the story that had been related to him by Antisthenes about the assembly of the hares and the lions. And the hares addressed the assembly and demanded equality. But the lion said, "Where are your claws and your teeth?" Now, Mr. President, a superpower has claws. And it has teeth. The superpower, as against this third world power, doesn't have to be impatient or impetuous. A superpower doesn't have to feel rushed. We can afford to be patient and let sanctions work. Well, they say the morale of our soldiers will suffer. Mr. President, we should have thought about this before we proceeded to double our forces and terminate the rotation policy in the Middle East. Nothing damages morale more than early large losses of life. Now, Mr. President, the nation is fixated on the so-called countdown or the deadline established by the United Nations resolution that demanding that Iraq evacuate its forces from Kuwait by January 15. Such self-imposed pressures need not dominate our decisions about what action to take in the Persian Gulf. The UN resolution only asks member governments to decide themselves how best to implement the demand that Iraq evacuate Kuwait. Why are we in such a rush to go to war when many avenues of diplomacy apparently are being explored by the United Nations, by the French, by the Soviet Union? Mr. President, how much time do I have left?
The senator from West Virginia, the President Pro Tem, has 13 and a half minutes remaining of his time.
I thank the chair. Now, Mr. President, the sanctions are working. Everybody agrees to that. Nobody disputes that. They have not accomplished the goal of driving Saddam out of Kuwait. But who would expect them to have done that in these few short months? We are told that not, I heard the distinguished senator from Georgia, Mr. Nunn, say yesterday, I believe, that Saddam Hussein had not been able to sell one drop of oil. Now, oil is the backbone of the Iraqi economy. And without the sale of oil, Hussein's currency is going to run out. He won't be able to buy. So the pressure on Saddam increases. And Mr. President, we could use that time. We could use the time for another 6 months. Let Ramadan pass. Let the hot months of June and July and August pass. We could make good use of that time. I read that a general, an American general, said that our forces are not ready yet. A little more time would enable our forces to get ready. I cannot believe that our forces would not benefit from additional training in the desert, that they might become better acclimated to that harsh climate. A little more time, and all of the buildup that we've read about can then be in place. And Mr. President, I've been disconcerted by reading that there is a divided command, that we have not yet unified all of the Allied forces under one command. Mr. President, I think it would be a mistake. I'm not a military man. I never served in any war. I built ships in World War II as a welder in the shipyards of Baltimore, Maryland, and Tampa, Florida. But common sense would tell me that there should be only one command. Again, let us resort to history. Hannibal, who has been proclaimed by some as the greatest soldier that the world has ever seen, knew that under the Roman military system, there was a divided command. There were two consuls, each had two legions, and that there was jealousy between the two consuls. While Hannibal exercised a single command, there was one brain, there was one will behind his planning, his designs, and his actions. And in the Battle of Cannae, which took place on August the 2nd, 216 BC, there was Paulus and Varro, the two Roman consuls. And Varro wanted to meet Hannibal on the plain. Paulus wanted to meet Hannibal in the hilly region. And they rotated their command. And on August the 2nd, it was Varro's day to command all of the Roman legions. Livy and Polybius both, the Roman historian and the Greek historian, agree that there were 8 Roman legions. 5,000 men to the legion. 40,000 Romans with an equal number of allies. 80,000 foot soldiers and horsemen. But the wind, the sun, and the dust were in the faces of the Romans. And the Roman armies were devastated. It was Hannibal's greatest victory in his 15 years in Italy. A divided command. And until Fabius Maximus began to initiate his policy of cunctatio, C-U-N-C-T-A-T-I-O, putting off meeting Hannibal's forces, knowing that Hannibal could not, like Saddam, could not replenish his resources. He could win battles, but he could not take walls and earthenworks around cities. Knowing that Hannibal would run out of spare parts, he'd lost most of his elephants. And in time, he lost his Numidian horsemen, his cavalry. Time ran out. And Fabius Maximus' policy of cunctatio, patience, avoid a battle just now. Let his forces attrit. Let them recline by attrition. That was the lesson of Cannae. That was the lesson of a divided command. Mr. President, the American people do not believe that we should rush in impetuously I read from the Washington Post of January 11th. This paragraph. While most Americans appear willing to go to war at some point after Tuesday if Iraq continues to occupy Kuwait, the latest post-ABC poll continues to show that only a minority of Americans want that war to begin when the deadline expires. Now, Mr. President, briefly, something should be said about the cost of this war in Treasury. We're going to end up paying for most of Operation Desert Shield ourselves, as we will discover when the supplemental appropriations measures are submitted. We'll end up fueling our deficit with this war and borrowing from the Germans and the Japanese at Treasury bill auctions to fund our budget deficit because they would not provide the money up front to help us. Our projected deficit for FY 1991 is $320 billion for FY 1991. This is an American operation with a superficial covering of internationalism. It is a bitter pill for the American people to swallow, coated with the noble embroidery of international order. And they will be swallowing the economic consequences of this war for years to come. According to the Veterans Administration, 72,000 World War veterans are alive today after 73 years. 8,600,000 World War II veterans are living. 3,900,000 veterans of the Korean War are living. 7,700,000 Vietnam veterans are alive. Society will be paying for health care and pensions for these veterans for many years to come, as we should. For fiscal year 1991, the Veterans Administration will provide in pension payments, readjustment benefits, and support for the Home Loan Guarantee Program in the following amounts broken out by specific war service. World War I, $737 million. World War II, $11.3 billion. Korean War, $3.3 billion. Vietnam, $8.3 billion. Total, $23.637 billion. Now, Mr. President, there's a question of burden sharing here. I was provoked and insulted and embittered when I read in the Washington Post Saturday, January 5, an Associated Press story headlined, "Japanese Mission to Gulf Ended." Japan, and I read therefrom, Japan's loan, 18, in Saudi Arabia has returned home, and officials were unsure today whether the government would send more. The seven doctors and nurses who made up Japan's second medical team all had left by December 28, the foreign minister said today, ending a mission plagued by too few volunteers. And what critics say is the Japanese people's unwillingness to consider Iraq's occupation of Kuwait their problem. Both missions drew only a total of 24 volunteers. Two ministry officials who accompanied the second team are the only Japanese personnel still among the more than 500,000 U.S.-led troops massed in the Persian Gulf region. Critics say Japan's inability to put together a 100-member medical team as promised in September reflects an insular mentality that has undercut government efforts to do more than send $4 billion, and that hasn't been sent yet, to help pay for the troop deployment and aid poor states in the area that have suffered from boycotting Iraq. Quote, "We're still not sure whether we really can make a meaningful contribution," said a foreign minister official speaking on condition of anonymity. He said another medical mission was possible but has not been worked out yet. In a poll last month, 62% of Japanese questioned opposed sending anything more than financial aid to the Gulf. So, Mr. President, while the American people will send their doctors to the Persian Gulf, while the American people will do without adequate medical care, will do without their medical personnel to a high degree, the Japanese cannot even send a volunteer team, a volunteer medical mission. And Mr. President, the U.S. is working nearly alone in this effort. It is clear that many, if not most, of our major allies in Europe do not share our enthusiasm for this adventure. Money is not pouring into our treasury in a genuine burden-sharing act by our allies. The administration is about to embark on what it calls the second phase of Operation Tin Cup. We have to go around begging for contributions for this effort. And I salute and congratulate the President of the United States and Secretary Baker for the leadership that they have given, for their dedication, for their skills, and for their success to a point in marshaling the strength of the United Nations behind this effort. But the total amount of cash and in-kind contributions provided by our allies as of the last report from DOD is less than $5 billion, an embarrassingly small sum. According to that report, the Germans have provided some $272 million and the Japanese some $426 million.
The chair will inform the senator that his time has elapsed.
Mr. President, I ask unanimous consent that I may proceed for 3 minutes.
Is there an objection? Without objection, so ordered.
Now, Mr. President, the two economic giants of Germany and Japan have hardly spoken eloquently with their pocketbooks. They have only opted to hold our coats while we take on Hussein. Mr. President, I think this is a shame and a disgrace that Germany and Japan, two countries which will benefit far more than will the United States, two countries whose need for the oil of the Middle East far exceeds our need, will stand by and cynically watch American men and women shed their blood in the sands of the Arabian Desert. And refuse to help to finance in their treasure, the cost of this effort. I think, Mr. President, I have difficulty finding the words to express my feeling that other nations would stand by. It's a monstrous disgrace, and the American people will remember it. Now, Mr. President, in closing, Francis Bacon spoke of the words that Croesus spoke to Cambyses, that peace was better than war, because in peace the sons did bury their fathers, while in war the fathers did bury their sons. Now, Mr. President, let Hussein get no comfort from the vote today. I anticipate that the resolution offered by Senator Nunn and others, including myself, will not carry. But as the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, I can assure Mr. Hussein that there will be no division when this is over. I pray that the president will exercise patience and take time. He has it within his hands. But Saddam must know that we will all stand together and that whatever the cost, the Senate will assume its duty responsibly. We will not let down our men and our women in the Middle East. And Mr. President, I know what it is to lose a grandson. And I know that there are many fathers and mothers and grandparents and wives and brothers and sisters who pray each night that their sons and daughters, their relatives, will come back home. I know what it is to lose. The greatest sorrow of my life was the loss of Michael. So, Mr. President, in the words of the epistle to the Hebrews, let us run with patience the race that is set before us.